นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนมัสสามิContinuing with the readings from Volume 3 of the Ajahn Sumedho Collected Teachings. And these are all talks from the book The Way It Is. And this is Chapter 22. And this is the first of a series of five chapters on dependent origination. So we started this one yesterday. In this way of the Four Noble Truths and Paticca-samuppada, the aim of meditation is to stop the mind's whirling. You abide in stillness, not as an attack against the conditioned world, but in order to see it in perspective. You're not annihilating it or criticizing it, or trying to get out of it in any way through aversion or fear of it. You're getting to the center, to the still point, where you can see it for what it is, and know it, and not be frightened or deluded by it anymore. And we do this within the limitation of our personal experience. So we can say, each one for themselves, because that's how it looks when we're sitting here. And yet, that still point is not in the mind, it's not in the body. This is where it's ineffable. Ineffable means something that can't really be pinned down or is mysterious or can't be defined or fixed. Ineffable. The full mind or the still point isn't a point within the brain, yet you're realizing that universal silence, stillness, oneness, where all the rest is a reflection and seen in perspective. And the personality, the karma, the differences, the varieties, and all these things are no longer deluding us because we're no longer grasping at them. So in this expression, and as Lumpur's putting it into words here, it's clear that it's hard to put it into words. It's ineffable. So that term means like the very word intuitive. You know, what does intuitive mean? Well, it's connected to our sense of reality, but not in a fixed or particularly specific way. So it's a bit of an edgeless, blurry kind of a term. Ineffable means you can't pin it down, you can't define it, you can't fix it. There's a quality of mystery that's necessarily part of things. So the full mind or the still point isn't a point within the brain. Or the still point is not in the mind, it's not in the body. So it's in a way you can say it's a point where of our attitude. It's a center of our experiencing the center of our heart. And even using words like center or stillness, they're necessarily only partially true. They're pointing to a particular quality, but all words, all analogies are partial. They can't really give you a complete or comprehensive picture, which to the rational mind can be a bit frustrating. Well, is it a full mind, or is it a still point, or is it not a point? What's the point? Is it a point or is it not a point? And where is it? So the rational mind can be frustrated or irritated by these kind of things. And I remember when somebody, one of these sort of university intellectuals, when they were asked about mysticism, they says, it begins in mist and ends in schism. Schism being kind of an argument or a division in the community. So mysticism begins in mist and ends in schism. So the kind of snarky comment made by a university professor. But I feel that that's part of the territory that that's important for us, that the Buddha's teaching mostly revolves around how to practice to get to that border of, you know, working with the body, the mind, the six senses, and so on. But then when that border of realization is crossed, then you're into the territory of the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, the unformed. There's the timeless, unlocated, selfless qualities. So all the usual signposts, all the usual structures that we can employ to describe things, time, individuality, place, and so on, they fall apart. They don't apply. That currency is not valid on that the other side of the border, if you look at it that way. And so that I feel it's important to recognize that when we talk about Dhamma, then there's a certain unimaginable quality to it when we're talking about these transcendent qualities like timelessness or awakened awareness. To say something is at the center or there's a point, these can only be partial descriptions. They can only be sort of symbolic ways of talking about it. As we examine the mind more and more, as we reflect and contemplate on it and learn from it, we all begin to realize the stillness of mind, which is always present, but which with most people is not even noticed, because the life of samsara is so busy, so frantic, that one is whirled around. Even though the still point is always here, it's never seen until you have an opportunity to abide in the stillness, rather than go around on the circumference. So yeah, Lumpur is sort of expanding on that theme. And this morning in the morning reflection, I was talking about that using the sun at the center of the solar system as an image, and if we align our attitude or take our that the sun is the central still point, and then the planets and asteroids and whatnot revolve around that. That's also, I feel, is quite a helpful image to have in mind. And then if we're on one of the planets or whirling around, then there's a lot of coming and going, a lot of rising and ceasing, and things can seem quite sort of disordered or confusing or agitated. Can't really see the patterns very easily of how things are working. But if we let go of and that being symbolic of self-view or attachment to birth and death, to beginnings and endings, gain and loss and so forth, and the sense world, all that change and movement and unpredictability can be exciting and interesting, frightening, stimulating. But and the attention can get very drawn to that, can be sort of wrapped up in that. But if that's let go of, and then the heart comes to that central position, like symbolized by the sun at the center of the solar system, then there's a much more of a quality of orderliness, and the patterning of things is much more visible, that there can be a sense of that all the different planets and asteroids and so on, they revolve around the sun. The sun is there, this massive center of gravity at the very heart of things. So I feel like that's a good, in terms of using an image, that's a good image of the Dhamma itself. So when we let go of self-centered perspective and awaken to a Dhamma-centered or nature-centered perspective, then what is experienced in the heart is a quality of orderliness, that what is called Dhamma-niyamata, the orderly nature of reality. The patterning of things is much more easily perceived, and the mind doesn't relate to things in such a personal way, so that there's when there is pleasure or success and comfort, then that's known, but we don't take it as a personal achievement or something that belongs to me. It's just, oh, this is the experience of sweetness or delight or pleasure. Things are kind of difficult or painful or challenging, rather than the mind going to, I've got this wrong, or how could I have lost that, or that was, how could this happen to me, or this isn't fair. then it recognizes that the orderliness of all, sometimes things are comfortable, sometimes they're painful. That's the way nature works. Sometimes there's a gain, sometimes there's a loss. That's how nature works. So the more that the heart abides in that, what Lumpur's calling the still point, or being at the center of things, then the mind sees things in terms of a natural order rather than in terms of personal gain and loss, success and failure, and pleasure and pain, and taking everything personally, or feeling that things are not fair, or that that they shouldn't be the way they are. But any questions, thoughts, reflections? Okay. Not that stillness is something to attach to either. We're not trying to become people who are still, just sitting here in stillness, not feeling anything. I know that some of you come in here, I think we were gathering for this retreat in the sala was our meditation hall on that particular retreat, if I remember correctly. You were sitting in the sala. I know that some of you come in here and create a personal world that you can inhabit through the hour of meditation, but that's not the way out of suffering. That subjective and personal world is very dependent on things being a certain way. It's so fragile and so ephemeral that it's destroyed by the slightest disruption. The refined world of tranquility is so lovely, so peaceful. Then somebody moves their robes, somebody's stomach growls, somebody snores. It's disgusting to be disturbed from these fine, tranquil states by coarse bodily functions. But stillness isn't tranquility. It's not necessary that we should be tranquil, but there's stillness when we can trust in abiding in the silence rather than following our compulsive tendencies. We all tend to think we've got to be doing something. We're so conditioned to do things that even meditation becomes some kind of compulsive activity that we're involved in. Develop this, develop that. I have to develop my samadhi. I have to develop the jhanas. You don't just come in here and sit. You come in here and develop! Exclamation mark. That's how we think. We feel guilty if we're not doing anything, not progressing, developing, getting anywhere. And yet, to be able to come in here and sit in stillness is not a very easy thing to do. It's much easier to make great meditation development projects, 5-year plans and so forth, yet you always end up at the still point, things as they are. This is a point Lumpur was making over and over again during that retreat, and is still very, very valid. Not trying to become people who are still. So that kind of stillness is not a sort of a frozen quality that we're just kind of locked in place, but it's tapping into that inner quality, that realization of Dhamma, that dimension of Dhamma where place doesn't apply. There isn't a here or a there. Location doesn't apply. Three-dimensional space doesn't apply. So stillness, again, is a relative term. So it's not a thing that has been moving that has stopped and is sort of locked in place, but it's tapping into that which is not defined by space. Just as the timelessness, when we say the Dhamma is timeless, it's not just a really, really short period of time. It's, again, tapping into that dimension of experience, that ayatana, that dimension of being where time doesn't apply, the past and future doesn't apply, whether it's a billionth of a second or whether it's a billion kalpas a billion universes having come into being and having come to an end. That time of any kind doesn't apply in that dimension. So that, which again, this is hard to imagine. You know, the thinking mind can hear those kind of words and go, huh? What? But this timeless, unlocated quality of Dhamma, of the Dhamma realm, this ayatana, this quality of our own being in its most profound and transcendent quality, that is what the practice is helping us to awaken to. And it's subtle. I remember talking about the, as Longpo was saying, that the the samsara is so busy, so frantic, one is whirled around. Even though the still point is always here, it's never seen until you have the opportunity to abide in the stillness. Many years ago, I for some reason or other, I had I think I was reading a lot of books from the City of 10,000 Buddhas in that era, and I had a dream of Master Hua coming to visit, and he said, and he couldn't speak very good English, but he spoke in perfect English with an English accent, predictably. And he said, "Bright, loud, and mobile is the false. Subtle and indistinct is the true." That was it. Bright, loud, and mobile is the false. Subtle and indistinct is the true. So that's one of those dreams where you woke up and went, all right, that was a message. Write that down. And it's exactly on this same thing. It's subtle. The true is subtle and indistinct. If it's bright and loud and mobile, don't trust it. And so, what Lumpur is talking about here is that when we talk about stillness or silence, it's not just kind of zipping your lip and stopping your speech. Or stillness isn't just sort of freezing in the spot. It's tapping into that dimension of being, that ayatana, which the Buddha used that term to refer to the unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed, that transcendent dimension of our own being that our heart is awakening to. And so when he was teaching on this retreat, also he... regularly was kind of when he could see that people were getting absorbed into sort of pleasant, tranquil states, he would he'd tell us to stop it. You know, say, "You're meditating, stop it," and to be not just using the time to even though that kind of quietness and tranquility and so inner comfort was very, very attractive, very pleasant, very wholesome in itself. In this retreat, Lumpur was making a point of saying, don't just, as it were, sort of hang out at the beach. It's not just a matter of finding a pleasant mind state and going and abiding in it, but using the inner space of the mind to investigate, to explore. And as you said, I know that some of you come in here and create a personal world that you can inhabit. You can inhabit through the hour of meditation, but that's not the way out of suffering. And so that dependency on tranquil states or having those pleasant conditions, even whether it's supported by people being quiet around you, or it's mostly coming from your own inner quietness, the concentration of the mind, the inner focus, then he's pointing to that as a very unreliable refuge. And also he was emphasizing how meditation isn't essentially a doing, and how bhava tanha, I've got to be doing this. This is a thing that I'm doing. I've got to become this and get rid of that, develop this, develop that. So, and it can sound like he's got a thing against meditation or against concentration, but Lumpur Zamedo has done a huge amount of formal practice over the years. But it's not a matter of not working with the mind or not attending, but rather looking at that compulsive bhava tanha, I've got to develop my samadhi, I've got to develop the jhanas, I've got to. And so even though bhavana, the word for meditation, literally means development, it's right there in the Buddha's teaching, it's the way in which the mind picks up that development, and it's always signified the the way it's taken over by Bhavatanna, Vibhavatanna, there's always a strong I must, I should, I've got to get rid of, I want to become, I've got to get more of this and get rid of that. The I am, I've got, I have to, I should. That's the in a way, that's the defining characteristic. That's the thing that makes a difference. And so I think a few weeks ago I was describing that this same way that Lumpur was teaching, and during one of the talks when Lumpur was expressing himself in this way, somebody in the front row chimed up and said, "But Lumpur, what are we supposed to do?" He said, "Don't do anything." It's a very sort of potent exchange, he wasn't trying to shame that person or make fun of them, but just highlight and bring a bright light onto that. You know, I should be doing something, and to look at that. I should, I must, I have to, and to recognize that, to train the heart to let go of that, not to have that be the defining feature of what we call the practice. And as you said, yeah, to be able to come in here and sit in stillness is not a very easy thing to do. So that quality of being totally awake and alert to the present, but not me doing anything, that's hard. That's hard to do. Like the subtle and the indistinct is the true, but it's hard to do. And it's interesting how when Lumpur is speaking in this way and giving this kind of teaching, there are people out of the Tibetan tradition then hearing him talk in this way would say, so Lumpur, how long have you been practicing Dzogchen and teaching this? And he would say, Dzogchen, what's that? And he really, at first, when he was first asked that, he really didn't know. He'd not heard the term before or was not aware that he'd heard it. And they are saying, well, what you're describing, this is sort of classic Tibetan meditation called Dzogchen, which is where the mind is guided to be fully awake, but not involved in doing anything or letting go of that sense of the doer and the kind of compulsive quality of meditation. And he said, is it called that? Oh, really? he was not aware of that, and the person who was asking him the question, I forget what the occasion was. I think it was a translator called Francesca Fremantle. I'm remembering. That's a name that springs to mind, that he was giving a teaching of this nature at some kind of Buddhist event that she was attending, and so she was sure that he must have had some kind of instruction in Dzogchen to be talking in this way. He said, no, this is just forest tradition, Theravada, just from my own practice. And so that it was an interesting exchange. And so then he became more, or was more introduced to that, or became more familiar with that. But a Dzogchen teacher that I got to know when I was living in America, Tsokni Rinpoche, he used to use the phrase undistracted non-meditation as a way of describing this sort of approach to practice. Undistracted non-meditation. So that there's a doing, there's effort being made to be undistracted, but it's non-meditation. It's like there's not a kind of a compulsive or a thingness to it. Again, it's a little hard to talk about, but there's a lot of parallels in this respect. And I co-led a retreat with Tsokni Rinpoche a number of years ago, which was great fun. It was a sort of Vajrayana Theravada duet, a 10-day retreat. So it was very interesting to hear him teaching along those lines, and the kind of languaging that they use in the Tibetan tradition, and how many very, very close parallels there are to this way of practice, both described by Lumpur Sumedho, so Lumpur Cha speaking in these kind of ways as well. Not that they're identical, but I would say there's a certain resonance, that there's a kind of rhyming. They're not exactly the same teachings or same practice, but there's a resonance, a relatedness in them that There was a, and he also, and the students of Tibetan Buddhism, they were interested to hear the Theravada languaging of things and how particular suttas and teachings from the forest tradition match things that they were familiar with, and then also similarly for the people who are out of the, more of the Theravada southern tradition, hearing the sort of Tibetan expressions and sort of seeing how they relate and finding different words for these particular areas. We can, one of the things that if we are particularly, say, goal-oriented, and we've spent our whole life sort of having plans and engaging in things, and our whole sense of being is built up around, you know, where we're going, you know, what we're doing, you know, what we're achieving, whether we're doing well at it or we're not doing well at it. If that's been our defining reality, this kind of approach to practice, where you're letting go of the that sort of self-centered driving element, it can be really disorienting and confusing and unsettling, because that, as Lungpo puts it here, to be able to come in here and sit in stillness, it's not a very easy thing to do. It's much easier to make great meditation development projects, 5-year plans and so forth. And so that can be such a strong habit. And I think a few days ago I was saying how I really had to hear Lumpur Sumedho giving many, many Dhamma talks, and hear him talking about becoming and letting go of becoming, and letting go of bhavatana vibhavatana. I had to hear him give dozens, probably hundreds of Dhamma talks before I started to really get a feeling for what he was talking about. It took a long, long time to really sink in and get a feeling for what that was about. And I think a lot of it was to do with my whole life had always been built around doing things, going places, having a program. And that in our conditioning, in our families, in our society, has taken as absolutely normal and completely sort of good and right in how you run your life. And as he said, it's much easier to be developing this, developing that, because that's our familiar territory. But to be able to practice sort of undistracted non-meditation, to work, to be awake, like it all in that exchange of Lumpur, don't do anything, just be awake. That it's challenging, because the massive predominance of conditioning is around doing something, and that if we can't do something, me doing something to get somewhere, then we are disoriented. The word disorient means to lose your east. Orient means the east, so it's like your compass is broken. It's like, oh, where are we? You've lost your east. You don't know which direction things are. So if there's a strong conditioning around having a direction and a plan and a thing that you're doing, and suddenly, poof, that's not there, that can be sort of confusing or upsetting. But I would say it's a really good kind of confusion. it can be challenging. But it's a helpful challenge, and that in a way we're learning to not be reliant on that kind of stimulus or that kind of refuge. You know, it's a bit like if you've been addicted to caffeine or something, and that you give that up, and then what's life like without your drug of choice? It's like, oh. Yeah, this is you're unsettled. You're on unfamiliar territory, and or maybe a better example is if you're in a foreign country, a country you've never been to, and you don't speak the language, and you can't really communicate. You don't know what the signs mean. They're in a script you can't read, and that sense of, oh, I'm not sure. Am I in the right bus station? Is this the bus station? Where's it going? What do these signs say? Where do I want to go to? And that can be unsettling, but also in the same breath, it's also liberating. So I feel that kind of unsettling quality of letting go of our sort of doingness, it's challenging, But it's if we can stay with it and to just let that unsettled feeling be digested, be really received and known, then on the other side of that, then we can find a great quality of freedom, that not having to depend upon the things that we were used to grasping and we took as being reliable. We find ourselves far more adaptable and able to work with a great variety of situations. And so that the stillness that Lumpur is talking about here, it's a stillness of attitude, even though there might be a lot of activity going on or noises in the room or things to be done. It's a stillness, a silence in the attitude, not in the field of perceptions. Oh, any questions, thoughts? Anagarika and Marie, if you can use the microphone.
Thank you, Ajahn. So what I would like to ask, because what I hear for me in my own practice, I could give just a simile, like when I just sit and for example, like things coming through the senses, and basically it's like in a movie theater, and it's like the mind becomes like the screen itself, and all these impressions they just arrive on the screen, and it's not, I don't know, it sounds like I should trust the screen or something like that, like this knowing quality I can. This is what for me is like, I can relate to that, but it's not, I don't know, for me it's more like the things come together, it's not really an essence or something, it's just a screen.
Not really a what?
Like just a screen, it's not like a, like Dhamma I could relate, like you have the screen where the mm-hmm. these, like the sound, or in a movie you have the sound, things moving on the screen, and that's what the mind is doing, it's just aware and not reacting. So I don't know, it sounds like I should trust that that's what is, like you are the screen itself, or where things are just arriving and you are just there and you don't really do anything, and it doesn't sound really, I don't know.
Well, I'd say it's every analogy is only partially relevant, but so in a way, it's like recognizing that the field of experience, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, remembering, our emotions and imagination and so on. Yeah, it's like a movie, but and so then remembering it's a movie is important. So and one of the ways that I talk about developing the inner listening as a meditation, the nada sound, then that's like noticing the screen upon which all of the images of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch are projected. So that I can listen to the nada sound now as I'm talking to you. So then that. I often talk about that or describe that as like a screen against which the whole field of experience is projected. So that's partially, that's kind of a partial analogy, because it's not as though the jitta is a kind of inanimate screen, like a piece of cloth that in a movie theater, because there is the responsivity. It's like a screen that is attuned to the quality of what is projected upon it, so that there is the Buddha wasn't encouraging us to be just like a video camera that just sort of receives images and sounds and records them registers the data of experience, but rather there's a recognition of what is wholesome, what's unwholesome, and then action, initiative to choose to act, to say something or to do something. That's part of the screen. So it's like a screen that is attuned to the images that are being projected upon it and can feed back to that which is projected and make choices and give direction based on what is wholesome, what's unwholesome, what's beneficial, what's not beneficial. That's probably stretching the image a bit far. But sometimes in meditation instruction, it comes across as if we're just trying to be like a video camera, just a sort of data recording unit, seeing, hearing, feeling, smelling, tasting, touching, remembering, all sankharas arise and pass away. And that there's a kind of emotional flatness or deadness or I call that a kind of unskillful dissociation. You know, you can do that with a meditation. You can kind of like disconnect your heart. And through concentration and through that attitude, you can make the mind more of like a data reception unit and just sort of flatten your heart's relatedness to what's being experienced. But I would say that's an unfortunate sidetrack or not the most helpful or beneficial or really liberating way of working with the mind. And because if you look just at the example of the life of the Buddha, he was totally awake, totally liberated. He was a Sammasambuddha, fully self-enlightened Buddha. So reached the pinnacle of potential of a living being, as far as we know, in terms of enlightenment, liberation. But he spent 45 years traveling around northern India, establishing a teaching incredibly, skillfully and thoroughly attuned the people he was with. If he was talking to a carpenter, he would use analogies of working with wood. If he was talking to a soldier, he'd use analogies of being shot on the battlefield. If he's talking to a mother, he would talk about raising children. If he's talking to a king, he'd talk about use images of running a country or the parts of a chariot. You know, he's really, really attentive to the situation he was in, who he was talking to. There's a lot of decision making there, establishing the Sangha, the 84,000 units of the Dhamma teaching, the Vinaya discipline. Yeah, he was incredibly creative, staggeringly creative and imaginative in his teaching and the way he structured the teachings, using similes, using lists. Graphic stories that he would memorable stories and images he would use. So he was far more than a data reception unit. He wasn't just sort of registering, hearing, seeing, feeling, smelling, tasting, touching, remembering, but rather there was a responsivity, an interaction. So as the screen of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching was received in his heart, then there's a responding, there's an attunement to what's going to be of benefit, what's going to be harmful, what is there something to be said, is there nothing to be said, okay, now's the time to speak, now's the time to be fierce, now's the time to be gentle, now's the time to make a pun, you know, crack a joke, you know, now's the time to say nothing. And so that I feel when we talk about this quality of awareness, awakened awareness, that it's important to see our capacity to act and make choices is also part of the way things are. So when we use an image like a screen, that's like the mind is a screen upon which all of these, say, sense impressions are projected, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, feeling, imagining. Yes, but the screen, the screen also affects what's going through the projector. You know, we can, like, I'm choosing words to respond to your question with. That's there's an attunement. Okay, what have I said so far? Have I said enough? Is she understanding? Am I getting lost in what I'm saying? Is it making sense? Is it not making sense? Yeah, so that attunement is a necessary part of mindfulness and wisdom. And when we talk about the mind being liberated or not attached to the sense world, it's attuned, it's in tune with the field of experience, but not attached to it, not identified with it. And I feel those are very, very different things. You understand the word attuned? So it's related to, in terms of attitude, it understands, and there's a feeling of where things are coming from. So that quality of what's wholesome, what's unwholesome, that's an intrinsic part of mindfulness, in its full development, is something going to be of benefit, or is it going to be harmful? Is it wholesome? Is it unwholesome? Is it in accordance with sila, or is it against sila? What's going to be the result of this action or these words? And I feel it's important to, it's good to create ideas or mental images, use similes for ourselves, but that image of a screen upon which the field of experience is projected, it's like, yeah, but it's an interactive screen. What's on the screen is related to what's projected onto the screen is affected by what the screen has received. If that makes sense. Any other questions, thoughts? Okay, to continue. With understanding more and more, there can be a letting go of the desire to develop and become anything. And as one's mind is freed from all that desire to become and get something, to attain something, truth starts revealing itself, is ever present, here and now. It's a matter of just being able to be open and sensitive so that truth is revealed. It's not something that is revealed from outside. The truth is always present, but we don't see it if we're caught up in the idea of attainments, of me having to do something, having to get something. So the Buddha made a direct attack on me and mine, quote unquote. That's the only thing that's blocking you. The obstacle is the attachment to a self-view. That's what is the problem. If you just see through that self-view, let go of that, you'll understand the rest. You don't need to know all the other kinds of elaborate esoteric formulas. You don't have to go endlessly into the complexity if you just let go of the ignorant view of I am. See that and know and understand the way of letting go of non-attachment. Then the truth reveals itself wherever you are, all the time. But until you do that, you'll always be caught in creating problems and complications. Avicca paccaya sankhara, sankhara paccaya vijnanam, vijnana paccaya namarupam, namarupa paccaya salayatanam, salayatana paccaya paso, pasa paccaya vedana, vedana paccaya tanha, tanha paccaya upadanam, upadana paccaya bhavo, bhava paccaya jati, jati paccaya jara marnam, soka parideva dukkha domanasu upayasa sambhavanti. All this means that if you keep insisting on being attached to the illusions of a self, to greed, hatred, and delusion, all you're going to ever get at the end are old age, sickness, and death, grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish. That's all you'll get for the rest of your life. It's a pretty boring prospect. But you can be free from that here and now through right understanding, seeing things in the right way. There can be the knowing of truth, in which we are no longer deluded by appearances or habits or by the conditions around us. So in a well-known teaching, as you said, the Buddha made a direct attack on me and mine. So self-view, sakkayaditti, is a sort of coarse level of that identification. So that's you can summarize that self-view as sakkayaditti is I am the body, I am the personality, this is who and what I am. You know, I'm a man, I'm a British, I'm a monk, I am talking, you know, the attachment to the body, the personality, is sakkaya ditti. A more subtle level of identification is mana, or asmi mana. Asmi means I am. Mana is conceit. So the conceit of I am. So whereas the that feeling of I-ness, meanness and minus in sakkaya ditti is usually associated with various aspects of the five khandhas, the body, our sensations, our thoughts, our perceptions, and so forth. The quality of asmimana is much, much more subtle. It's the I feeling, not specifically attached to any kind of any of the five khandhas, really. And so it's more pervasive, more subtle, harder to see, but very much the troublemaker. So the first level, so sakkaya ditti is seen through amongst the first three fetters that has to be let go of in order for stream entry to be realized. That's the very first of the 10 fetters is that kind of self-view, sakkaya ditti. And asmimana is sort of number 8 of the 10 fetters, so that's not let go of until arahatship is realized. So that's like a whole sort of three other levels of subtlety until that is really understood and let go of. And when the Buddha spoke about that, when he was giving a teaching to Meghya, which you find in the Udana, the Meghya Sutta, and the Buddha says, to be free of the conceit, I am, that is Nibbana here and now. That's a simple way that he phrased that. So that when that is, that I making and mind making, that asmimana is let go of, then in that moment that is seen through and is not identified with, right there, that is the quality of Nibbana. There's a great peace, clarity, and freedom of Nibbana in that seeing. Then, if you've been wondering how this was a teaching on dependent origination, this is what Lumpur gets to here. If that ignorant view of I am, if that is clung to, if that avijja is embodied in that way of I am, that avijja means not seeing clearly, or nascience, not knowing, not seeing clearly, that is then the trigger, that's the seed for that whole process, the whole 12 links of the dependent origination process to kick off and to get rolling. And then the final part of it, sokha parideva dukkha dominasa upayasa, sorrow, lamentation, old age, sickness and death, sorrow, despair and anguish. That's where the mind ends up. And in another teaching in the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, then the speaking about conceiving the I am, the manyati, the Buddha says, you know, that conceiving, that creation of the I am, he says it's like a disease, it's like a cancerous tumor, it's a burden, it's stressful, it's something alien. So he really speaks about it in a very pointed way, that get to know this, that be aware of this, and that when it's really known, when that I am feeling, and it doesn't have to be spelled out in words in our thoughts, but just that the attitude of the heart, that's a, I am, this is me, this is mine, this is I am this, even if it's not articulated in our thoughts, let alone in our spoken words, that when that's really understood and let go of, then in that moment there is a wakefulness and awareness that the mind is not sort of zoned out with the I am is let go of. It's not just like going unconscious or blanking out at all. There's a clarity of awareness, but it's not formed around any kind of I, me, or my feeling. And so then we call that clarity vijja, or awakened awareness. Maybe the last thing to say, when we use the English word ignorance, it usually is taken to mean not having information, like you're ignorant of the what the program is for the last 2 weeks of the winter retreat. You haven't got the information. So ignorance in its use of that as a translation for avijja is more like unmindfulness or unawareness or not seeing clearly. So it's not about information. It's about clarity of awareness, a clarity of knowing. So vijja is an awakened awareness. It's not knowing, having information about something, and not even having a conceptual understanding of something, but rather it's that quality of awareness itself. And then avijja is unawareness, not seeing clearly, that quality of knowing or cognition being clouded or distorted or limited. So it's helpful when we talk about ignorance conditions formations, or the ignorant view of I am. That's it's not just because you haven't got the information, it's that quality of attitude, where there's a aspect of clinging, of identification, that there's a distortion, an unclarity in the attitude. And that's the issue, that's the cause of the whole dependent origination cycle kicking off, is that not seeing clearly. So when the mind is established in vijja, in awareness, then that whole process doesn't get launched. And again, as I was saying yesterday, Lumpur would sum it up very, very succinctly, saying if you start off with avijja, you end up with suffering, with dukkha. If you start off with vijja, with awareness, then you end up with nibbana. So that's the pocket version of the whole process. So any questions, thoughts, reflections? Yes, Maureen, if you could use the microphone.
So this is a comment, but kind of talking about what Anne-Marie was going, like in experience when I think of when I'm experiencing that awareness that Lungpur is talking about, and how he's always encouraging us to, he'll say trust in that awareness or rest in that awareness. One thing that I find helpful for myself in knowing what that experience is, even as an experience, it's one thing, but even conceptually, and I'm going to use a dirty word here, Abhidhamma. but just, when I have the awareness being mindfulness, or Lungpur will say it's consciousness. Sometimes he'll interchange consciousness and mindfulness and awareness, is my understanding, if that's correct. That in Abhidhamma, like consciousness is accompanied by all these different mental factors. And so just the understanding that when awareness is present, and if you're mindful, if mindfulness is present and there's a wholesome, consciousness present, there's all different mental factors also present at the same time because they're accompanying it. And so I think that's a helpful reminder, because otherwise you can kind of feel like that awareness is just this kind of whitewash of, it's just one thing, but it's not just one thing. There's mindfulness present, there's effort, there's, all kinds of wholesome mental factors that are all there at the same time. And I find that a helpful reflection about that state of awareness, that it's not just one thing, it's actually a composite. I don't know if that's helpful.
Yeah, I think it's a different expressions of the teaching are meaningful for different people, and that I really encourage us all to use our practice to investigate, see how things work, and then in a way develop our own language. And so if the format and the languaging that you find in Abhidhamma is something that's supportive, well, excellent. You know? But for somebody else that might not work, or it might seem to be more complicated or be confusing. And so I feel it's good to sort of take your own experience as the basis, and then find how the words of the suttas or the words of various different teachers, or whatever source you might get that from, to language it for yourself, and find a way of phrasing things and forming things that bring about that quality of clarity and help the heart to know things most so directly and fully and completely. And people work in different ways, and so that I feel it's having the confidence to find your own language, your own symbolism. Some people, the words and concepts don't work at all, but sort of mental images or colors, forms, they're the medium that their mind most comfortably uses, and that's the language that works for them. So, because the point is to end suffering, and it's not a matter of the particular expressions that we use and the terminology, but rather using the concepts or the forms, the words, the images, the structure, the sort of mental structures to bring about that kind of that transformation, that liberation of the heart. So I really encourage an experimental approach, and then using the things that work for us as individuals. Sometimes we can be very subservient, and we'll think, the Ajahn doesn't talk about that, so therefore I shouldn't think in that way because that's kind of not allowed here. But I feel that Lumpur Cha's style and Lumpur Samedo similarly, they're very broad in that respect. That was one of the things I really appreciated about this community, this teaching, is that there is that sense of sort of finding your own way and finding your own language. Or just like when Ajahn Sumedho came as a very young bhikkhu, he'd only been a bhikkhu for a few weeks when he met Lumpur Cha, and he'd been a novice for a year, but he'd only just had his Upasampadaya, so he was not very experienced as a bhikkhu at all. And then he met Ajahn Chah and asked if he could come and practice at Wat Pa Pong for some time. And Lumpur Cha asked him what kind of meditation he'd been doing. And he described this Chinese meditation method that he'd learned from the teachings of Master Xu Yun, from these books, Chan and Zen Training, of investigating the question, who am I? And so then, and he thought that Ajahn Chah was going to say, well, stop doing that. And you have to, if you're going to stay here, you've got to do my method. And to his amazement, when he described that, and he had a translator that could explain it, Ajahn Chah said, so what are the results that you get from that? And he said, I feel there's very good results, it's very beneficial, and I find it extremely helpful. And he just said, okay, carry on doing that. So the young Ajahn Sumedho was really startled, like, wow, oh, that was unexpected. And later on, when he learned some Thai and had been there for some time, I believe this is as I remember the story, he asked Ajahn Chah, so that practice that I talked about, this using the question, who am I, had you ever heard of that before? And Lumpur said, no. And oh really, he says, it wasn't anything familiar, said, no, I never heard of it before, but you said that it was having beneficial results, and I knew that most of what you were going to learn from a Wat Pa Pong wasn't a meditation technique anyway. So I was very happy for you just to carry on using that. So there's that kind of liberality. People using the tools that work for them, people finding their own expressions. I think it's important, and those things also, they change, they evolve over time. So something that was valuable for you 5 years ago doesn't really carry the same meaning, or it's not so helpful. And then something else you just discovered, and or a different way of phrasing things is, right, that makes a big difference. And just you're not being unfaithful or irresolute just because you changed your approach or you changed the meditation method. It's just that worked then, and you're 5 years older or 10 years older, and things have moved along or changed, so something else works now. And so that sense of adaptability, and also I feel it's important for people to not thinking that they're being disrespectful if they don't follow the teacher's instructions sort of in the same letters, in the same words. Like, I should think of consciousness exactly the same way that Lumpur Sumedho does. And, well, maybe you don't. He uses the word consciousness in a very particular way. And so maybe you've got your own word that you prefer to use for that. You like to talk about mind or nature of mind or awareness, and that the word consciousness carries other tones for you. So it's not being disrespectful or unfaithful to not be thinking in those terms. It's like, okay, you can appreciate where the teaching is coming from, you have a sense of what it means, and then you can rephrase it or form it in a way that fits you or fits your own character. And so applying your own understanding, I think, is really crucial, really making the teaching work for us. So we're not just obeying a form and hoping that the form is going to liberate us, but we're actually taking it in and making it our own. And when we're not simply just obeying a structure or a form, but rather we're, developing tools that actually work to do the job. So I will leave it there today. We've got the sitting at 7:30, so I'll try to be more scrupulous about the ending time these days.